Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus, the key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Backchat. If the Nature podcast is Mother Earth, think of Backchat as a collection of mysterious dwarf planets in the far reaches of the solar system. We're back to digest our favourite stories from this month's science. I'm Kerry Smith and joining me are one regular correspondent and two special guests. The regular first, Ewan Calloway, is here.
Why am I just regular? I'm special. Hi, I'm Ewan Calloway. I'm a reporter at Nature in London covering genetics, evolution, Neanderthals, you know, stuff like that.
Very special indeed, Ewan. You are right. Even more special today are the visitors we have in London from the Washington, D.C. Office of Nature. Our two U.S. news editors join us. We have Matt Crenson.
Hi, I'm Matt Crenson. I've been with Nature only since last May, and I'm the chief news editor in Washington.
And we have senior news editor in Washington also, Lauren Morello.
Hello. So my background is in climate change, but I gleefully edit everything.
Excellent. I've seen that glee. I like that glee. This month, we will be spying on some dwarf planets which look a little bit icy and a little bit active in various ways. We're going to plan NASA's next phase of missions for them, and we're going to discuss gene editing, the recent controversy over the new CRISPR technique, and what it might teach us about extinct species, maybe, she says, with a question mark at the end. First, Lauren, you've been working on quite a lot of stories recently with our reporter Alexandra Whitsey, who is one of our biggest space nerds. So tell us about NASA's plans, first of all. NASA doesn't buy its diary like just for the next year, does it? It's got all of its diaries for the next kind of decades.
It plans over a really long time period. And so they have just asked planetary scientists to send in proposals for the next mission in what they call the Discovery class. All that means is they'll spend $450 million or less, and that's going to launch in the 2020s.
And is that a lot of money by NASA standards, or is it chump change?
I would say that's pocket change.
Okay.
So what are they going to spend this on? I mean, these are some big decisions to make.
So there are 28 proposals duking it out for this one little launch slot. And Alex, who you said is our chief space nerd, kind of looked at all of these proposals, which aren't public. So she chased them all down, made a spreadsheet, and then we picked some themes out. So there are a couple of possibilities. We could go back to the moon because we haven't had any samples, moon rocks, anything taken from the moon since the last Apollo mission, which was in 1972, and we've been studying the moon from afar. We could go to an asteroid. They're very trendy now. The European Space Agency landed on Comet 67P last year with Rosetta, and now everybody wants a space rock. There are lots of things orbiting Mars, and now we could go look at its two little moons, which are essentially overgrown rocks. Or we could go check out volcanoes on Venus or Io, which is a moon of Jupiter.
I feel like going back to the moon is just like going on holiday to your next-door neighbor's house. But people are excited about it.
People are excited about it, and, you know, maybe giving this a little extra push is the fact that China sent a lander to the moon last year, the U-2 mission. U-2 means Jade Rabbit. It's the third in a series of Chinese moon missions, and they've already got the fourth and the fifth missions planned out. So there's a little bit of USA, USA about going back to the moon.
But, I mean, you had to work quite hard here. You have numbered these options. These are 3 to 5 of 28 different plans.
It's more emissions than that, but it's 5 categories. And I would say that maybe this was not a popular choice that we made with planetary scientists. We got some some pushback on this?
Well, because they're all, you know, they're duking it out for this pocket change, as we've already referred to.
Yeah, I mean, NASA's planetary science budget has been declining, so it's a little bit like fighting over crumbs. And Alex maybe got some critical mail suggesting that we might influence NASA's decision. But, you know, if one nature listicle is influencing NASA, then the U.S. space program might be in trouble. So just for the record, we're not partisans. We're not like Team Saturn or Team Mars or even Team Moon.
Well, and it seems from other recent discoveries just in the last week that you've been editing as well, that there's going to be plenty of stuff to find wherever we go, right? There's loads of stuff turning up that's fun.
Right. So Alex, our reporter, went to the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Houston, Texas. And based on the findings coming out of that meeting, it seems like the really trendy thing, if you're a planet or a moon, is to have an icy plume or a buried ocean. Enceladus, which is a moon of Saturn, has a buried ocean, and we knew there were these plumes coming off of it. And recently, we discovered that the buried ocean has hot springs at its bottom, and that's where the plumes are coming from. So that's the first hydrothermal venting activity outside of Earth. And the plumes that come off of Enceladus go and help form Saturn's rings, which is just kind of mind-blowing.
That's freaking cool. I usually hate space, but that is cool.
And the reason that they look solid to us is that the dirt is going around really fast. Mm-hmm. So it tricks your eye. And let's see. So we found ice and craters on Mercury. That's from the Messenger mission, which is going to die a planned and gory death next month when it plunges into the surface of Mercury after several years. And there's a dwarf planet called Ceres, and there's a NASA mission that is started orbiting that dwarf planet on March 6th, and it saw these two mysterious bright spots, and nobody knew what they were. And now it looks like they are icy plumes, because everybody has an icy plume.
And I have to say that's renewed my interest in Ceres somewhat, because I have a nostalgic kind of link to Pluto, but Ceres was sort of a new one on me, and I just couldn't get that excited about
Ceres
it.
Ceres is cool. So it's an asteroid, and it's a dwarf planet. It's kind of like that seen in, was it Chinatown? She's my mother, she's my sister. But it's the largest asteroid, I think, in the solar system. If I get that wrong, Alex is going to send me hate mail.
How many Neanderthal genomes could you sequence for $450 million, Ewan?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I don't know how many Neanderthal genomes they could sequence. The first one cost probably more than $10 million, but it's getting cheaper. So we could probably sequence maybe 1,000 Neanderthals if we could actually
find 1,000.
If we could actually find 1,000 Neanderthals. What the value of that would be, I'm not sure. But
do you want your brain to break? NASA spent about $1 billion on a mission to monitor carbon dioxide. The first one failed at launch because they went with a rocket that turned out to be faulty, and then they had to rebuild it and launch it and redesign it for a different kind of rocket. So, you know, that's
sometimes oops. Things don't work.
Yeah.
Is this why they only get one mission out of 28? Because they keep messing up all the time? And I mean, I guess money is short all around the U.S. government for science. Is that why there's only one small mission to fund?
Right. Well, they plan these far in advance. So, I mean, that's part of the reason they fund missions at various price points, but it has been really hard for planetary scientists in the last couple of years. I edited a very sad story about 2 years ago when the planetary science budget was cut. Alex called around and had sad postdocs talking about how they were going to have to get out of the planetary science game because they were never going to get jobs because there was no money for missions. And the situation has gotten a little better, but it's not great. It's expensive to go to space.
A long time ago, I covered a Mars landing. This was the Mars Pathfinder mission back in the 1990s. And people were asking me if it was worth all the money. And I don't remember exactly what the dollar value was. But it occurred to me at the time that one of the Jurassic Park movies had just come out. And it occurred to me that the Jurassic Park movie had made more money than the mission cost. So, you know, here's people are willing to pay more for fake dinosaurs running around in the jungle than they are to, you know, explore a real new frontier. And for what we pay, I mean, it sounds like a lot of money when you write all those zeros out. But when you consider what we pay for everything, I think it's well worth the money spent.
Well, I'm surprised. Maybe NASA's missing a trick that they could be funding space launches, these missions, by making films. Seriously.
Yeah, right.
Or at least by, you know, like, I don't know, branding themselves a little bit better.
But the last, you know, the last few kind of launches that have been on all of our radars, Rosetta and the Curiosity Lander, that they were real media events. They were really kind of snazzy and they had lovely videos to go with them. And there was a real sense of drama and crisis if they went wrong.
But that's going to happen in July. The New Horizons mission has been on the way to Pluto for about a decade, and it's going to make its closest approach on July 14th. And Pluto, which has been downgraded from a planet, is the last of the classical planets to be visited. And so New Horizons is going to get very close. We only have really bad, blurry pictures of Pluto from the Hubble Space Telescope, and we're finally going to get a look at this thing. And it's going to be awesome. Podcast listeners, you're going to be sick of Pluto in mid-July.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, one day I'm sure there will be an IMAX movie. And so, you know, that's part of the value of these things is the entertainment value and just the sheer awesomeness of being able to explore these places.
Well, let's move on from space to something that was quite controversial this week. A comment piece in Nature and then some associated comment pieces elsewhere and lots of coverage has focused on a moratorium that's been proposed on a new-ish gene editing technique. Matt, your turn.
Sure thing. It's called CRISPR. What it is a very high precision way of editing DNA. And, you know, we hear so much about new techniques for understanding and sort of transcribing and changing DNA that our eyes kind of glaze over sometimes. But this one is really different. This is a technique that's about 3 years old, and it's just so precise and so easy to do that people are starting to worry about sort of science fiction type things like designer babies. So there have been two editorials in the last couple weeks, one in Nature and one in Science, advising some caution in applying this to human embryos. One of them, the one that came out in Nature, actually suggested a moratorium on research in human embryos. And the one in Science that came out more recently doesn't go quite that far, but says that we ought to really have a good think about this before moving forward. You know, that's all really interesting, but I think sometimes it obscures just how incredibly cool this is.
Do you have a sense, can you tell us how much easier it is for scientists who want to go in and kind of change the sequence of a bit of DNA?
Right.
I don't really have a good concept of that.
Well, yeah, here's a good example. In the past, every time you would go out and do interviews about some new genetic technique, you'd say, you know, how about Jurassic Park? And they'd say, no, forget it. Never going to happen. But there's actually an effort using this technology to create a woolly mammoth you're not going to create dinosaurs because for that you'd have to have a complete DNA sequence of a dinosaur. And it's just they've been gone too long for that. But woolly mammoths have only been extinct for about 10,000 years, maybe a little more. And there are frozen specimens in Siberia that you can get enough DNA out of. So what you would do is you would use this technique and you'd use an elephant to gestate it.
I mean, so the gist is, right, that you're going to take we've got the woolly mammoth genome. It's got some amount of genetic differences between an Asian elephant, which is its closest relative, and you're just going to one by one introduce those differences into the genome of an elephant egg cell, and you'd have a woolly mammoth, which is pretty cool. People are also doing this with the passenger pigeon, or they're considering doing it with the passenger pigeon, which went extinct much more recently, maybe 100 or 100 and some years ago, which is even more closely related to pigeons living around today. I think the technology for this, you know, for de-extinction is a bit ahead of the conversation, I think, about whether we should we be bringing back these animals. I mean, why? You know, is it just because we can? You know, what are we going to do with them? There used to be billions of passenger pigeons that would kind of roam across North America, obscuring the sky for minutes on end. Is that what we want? I mean, do we want woolly mammoths, you know, grazing in Montana?
The answer is yes,
right.
Because if we have them, we can make a great film, and then we can fund all of NASA's future space missions.
There you go.
With the woolly mammoths that we
can
made.
Kill them again.
Right. Well, the world is, and that's an interesting question. The world has changed a lot since these species went extinct. So there's more to it than simply figuring out their specific genetic makeup.
Something has filled their slots.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't uncrack the egg.
I think climate change might have erased their slot entirely in most places in the world, right?
Well, and do we really need more pigeons? rock doves. I don't want the pigeon lobby to send me hate mail.
I think you mean rats with wings.
In London, we do not need any more pigeons. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we even had a reporter was telling me she was talking to a source who suggested that, you know, some billionaire could decide to give his daughter a unicorn for her birthday. And that may be a little bit far-fetched, but that's the sort of thing that people who, you know, who understand this are saying, which just shocks me. But on a more sort of practical level, it could be done in an IVF clinic. It's not so complicated that you need a fancy molecular biology lab. So it really does open a Pandora's box.
This discussion of woolly mammoths and making a unicorn and this sort of thing that sounds quite jovial and quite fun, is that going to help or hinder the debate about whether we should be doing this with human cells?
I would say that the people who wrote these commentary pieces we're talking about would probably be horrified to hear us talking about all of this way, because it really they really have some serious concerns. And what they want is a very sober discussion of the issues involved, and exactly the opposite of this sort of fanciful stuff we're talking about.
So here's the question. Can you put the genie back in the bottle? Is a moratorium practical? In, you know, was it the early 1970s, the Asilomar Conference kind of put the brakes on an earlier form of genetic engineering? But these days, I mean, science has been globalized and democratized, and there are a lot more people doing this kind of stuff. Can you get them all to agree, or is this based on some kind of Cold War idea that the U.S. can say stop and everybody backs off?
Well, the word is that someone somewhere has already applied this to human embryos, not brought them into the world, but at least tried it out. And in most places, it would be in most countries, it would be illegal to create a human baby using this technology. But the fear is that somebody somewhere will give it a try. There are lots of legitimate or potentially legitimate uses for it. There's ways you can use it to treat diseases in adults. For example, you could use it to alter a person's genes so that they were more resistant to HIV. There are actually experiments trying to do that right now and see if it really works there. And then in embryos, you could, for example, if you were concerned that a child might inherit Huntington's disease or something like that, you could go in and edit the genes to edit out that mutation. But of course, there are already technologies that you can use. If you have Huntington in your family, you can do IVF and you can do diagnosis of the embryos beforehand to see if they've inherited the gene and then implant the ones that don't have it. So those sorts of questions are the ones that need to be debated. When would it be good to use this?
I find it really interesting that this debate about genome editing using this new technology, CRISPR, is happening right now, because literally 1 or 2 months ago, the UK government took a step towards legalizing another form of germline modification, so-called mitochondrial replacement, which is intended to prevent the transmission of so-called mitochondrial diseases like various muscular dystrophies and things like that. And it's done through quite old technology, basically moving the nucleus of an egg with diseased mitochondria into a donor egg from another woman with healthy mitochondria.
Yeah, so 90s.
But it's so 90s. But yet, there was this big ethical review, you know, all this stuff, you know, public consultation. And the conclusion was that this is germline modification. And, you know, by and large, the public and bioethicists and scientists said, you know, in this case, you know, the benefits outweighed the potential risks. And this is a, you know, potentially good use of this technology. This hasn't happened yet in, you know, to prevent the transmission of disease in children. But lots of embryos have been created, just taken towards, you know, maybe 10 days in the lab. So it strikes me that a lot of the debates surrounding mitochondrial replacement could be ported over to this.
And that's, I suppose, the issue, isn't it? These conversations similar to this in tone and qualitatively similar are happening every time there's a new technique that sort of makes people feel a bit queasy, and then everyone gets over it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it may well be that we don't get over this. I mean, there are safety issues that haven't been resolved. It's a very precise editing technique, but no one knows how precise it is. You could be modifying other genes that you don't know about. And if you're going in and doing a lot of different modifications at the same time, like you would if you were trying to make a woolly mammoth, for example, that increases the chances of having unintended effects. And the fact that it's germline, meaning that it's passed on, you know, down through the generations after you've done it, not just to one person, means that those changes are permanent and it might take a very long time for you to really understand what all the effects are.
Now, we've got one more order of business, and it's because there are so many Americans in the office that I thought, you know, we should just address a few of the little differences that divide us. But, you know, this common language that we have does sometimes cause misunderstandings. Lauren, you've got a classic example of this.
I do. First of all, I want to say that you can't see my USA foam finger. No,
actually, I wondered why you brought that.
Actually, I'm lying. I have no foam finger. But I was editing a story probably a month or two ago on a report on geoengineering. So I edited this story. I sent it off to the sub-editors in London. I got it back, and they had changed the headline to "Geoengineering Scheme Mooted." Now, to a British sub-editor, that means slightly dry academic report discusses plans for geoengineering. It's a very neutral headline. To an American, that means dastardly geoengineering plan stopped. So we had a little negotiation and we changed out scheme and we changed out mooted, which might be one of the least favorite verbs of American nature editors. The other one is hotting up. Mm. In America, we say heating up.
I'd like to moot that we ban the word moot from nature. Perhaps we should just put that in a style guide.
That is our ongoing struggle because it confuses everybody.
The problem is that it's nice and short, and so it works in a headline.
We won a major victory, though. The American Nature editors have gotten the chief sub-editor here to agree that we can say truck instead of lorry.
Mm-hmm. That's impressive.
That was years in the making.
With this small but significant victory, we are going to end the show. And all that remains is to thank you all for joining me. Lauren Morello, Ewan Calloway, Matt Crenson, thank you all for coming in. Where can people find you on Twitter if they so desire?
So I am at LMorello_DC.
I am at Ewan Calloway.
And I'm at MM Crenson.
Excellent news. Thank you all for coming in. God bless America. That was Backchat.
The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.